From DeLand to Grand University in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 13th day of August, 2026. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets, not with Matt Bennett as he's out of the office this afternoon, but rather with Dave Chatterton of Strategic Farm Marketing. Then we'll turn our attention to edge-of-field conservation practices. There was a field day outside of Cisco, Illinois today. I attended and talked to a member of the Agricultural and Biological Engineering team right here on this campus. And then as we close out our time together, we'll take a look at the weather forecast too with Mike Tenora at T-Storm Weather. That's tstorm.net online right here on Illinois Public Media's Closing Market Report. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
September corn for the day settled $4.48, down 9. December at 4.72, 8¾ lower. And the March at 4.87¾, 8¾ lower as well. September beans, 3/4 higher, $11.66. The settlement price, November 11.82 at a quarter, down 1. January down a penny and a quarter at $11.97¾. Bean meal off $1.10. The bean oil 37 cents lower. December soft red winter wheat $6.68¼, a penny and a half lower. The hard red December down 3 cents. It finished at $7.34¾. Live cattle futures $3.75 lower at $2.20. And a nickel, feeder cattle down $2.15, and lean hogs down $1.42½. Matt Bennett is out of the office for the afternoon. Dave Chatterton is here. He's with Strategic Farm Marketing right here in Champaign County. Thanks for joining me on short notice. I want to know about the corn market. You can talk about yesterday, the up move that came along with the USDA report and the below trend line yield that they released. And then, of course, how things proceeded today.
Yeah, Todd, pretty interesting action. I think the bulls in the market a little bit disappointed here that we didn't kind of have that follow through today to the momentum that we gained yesterday. At the end of the day, I guess, you know, in our view, Todd, when we see market go up 20 cents one day, go down 10 the next day, we're still up net 10. Hey, we'll call that a little bit of a victory, especially considering the history of that August report from USDA and how volatile it can be. Having said that, I think it, you know, pretty interesting here that the corn action today, there is, you know, we definitely caught a few people off guard yesterday with that yield estimate and coming in well below the trade expectations. I think, you know, ourselves or a lot of other people in the analyst marketplace that have been talking about lower corn yields, but didn't maybe necessarily expect the USDA to make it that big of a move in the August report. We had the acreage increase to temper that just a little bit, but the fact that they increased demand gave us a new crop balance sheet that's printing a 1.6 type of a handle for new crop carryout. And that's just above that 10% mark that we kind of consider the make or break in terms of what can turn into a very bullish situation very quickly with a few other problems. When we see that stocks to use historically drop below 10%, it's a little bit of a warning sign. Today, I think, you know, market focused a little bit on what happened with the Ukrainian ideas and this potential offer from Ukraine to Russia. But I think a bigger thing is we're still watching, you know, the long tail, I guess I'll call it, of what was a record crop in Argentina last year. We continue to see their 5 offers on corn be competitive with U.S. offers really through late summer and into early fall. And I think, you know, maybe today's export sales are a great, you know, kind of example of that, Todd. You know, combined export sales for new and old U.S. corn this week, 53 million bushels. That's a very historically solid number, but it compares to a 77 million bushel total the same week a year ago. And I think just a little bit of a drag here on you know, feeling a little bit of headwind here from the long tail of that Argentine crop.
I suppose that you have been thinking and talking with folks about the agronomics of overnight temperatures, a crop that is not a trendline crop, at least at this point, but that has gone through most of what you would expect to be the roughest part of the weather, because August doesn't look terribly bad. How much grain fill can we get out of it? And do you suppose we have a big crop, because it is the second largest corn crop on record, getting bigger? Or do we have a crop moving down in size and continuing to get smaller?
Yeah, Ted, I think we're down to the last, you know, typically the last 10 to 15% of grain fill, which can be very important here. And Weather during August has definitely been much more favorable. We have had some of these nighttime temperatures here. I think we had 5 or 6 nights in a row here in Champaign County. This last couple of nights of temperatures that didn't get below 70 overnight. That's typically, you know, it's not necessarily a train wreck, but it's not ideal either in terms of that last amount of grain fill. We continue as we're going, you know, into the fields, getting reports from our producers, from our agronomy team, and you know, looking at stuff ourselves to find, I guess, more pollination problems, tip back, nitrogen, you know, loss, and a combination of a number of problems that is limiting yield. So I think ideas have certainly stabilized. They've stopped going down, I guess, for sugar, maybe in that sense. I'm not sure that they go back up a little bit. We're still below USDA in terms of our internal numbers as far as where they're, you know, what they're doing. We're using a 179 nationally. That's, you know, getting in the neighborhood of where USDA has come to, but and we're at a 203 for an Illinois number. That's a big difference from the USDA at 212. And even if I just plug, you know, Illinois itself in as a 202, Todd, and instead of a 212, we're taking the national yield down to about 179.5. So I think those conversations are still coming, and we're getting a little bit closer to that as the crop tour season gets started next week. We got Pro Farmer going on next week. We'll have a number of private tours as well as the co-ops and the general things that happened this year. So I think the trade will be watching those pretty closely.
Do you think the Iowa crop will get bigger?
I don't. I think the Iowa crop is good. I'm not sure, talking to our customers and from what we've seen, that it's necessarily a record crop as indicated by USDA. I don't necessarily think it's a bad crop or it gets much smaller. I think you can take both the Iowa and Illinois numbers from USDA yesterday with a little bit of scrutiny. And, you know, to their credit, before it sounds like I'm being too critical of USDA, you know, the August report, you have to remember, first state-by-state yields of the sequence here for the year. It should be seen as a marker or a starting point. It should be something that we debate going forward. I think, you know, that's what we're in the middle of doing here.
Hey, thank you much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Todd.
That, of course, is Dave Chatterton. He is with Strategic Farm Marketing right here in Champaign County, Illinois. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. Don't forget that today we'll record our Commodity Week program and post it to the website at willag.org by about 6 o'clock this evening. Our theme music, by the way, for both programs, the Closing Market Report and Commodity Week, are written, performed, produced, and courtesy of Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. Commodity Week is our weekly look at what's happened in the world of agricultural markets. Be sure to listen online at WILLAG.org, or you may hear the whole of the program tomorrow during this hour on our home station, and many of these radio stations will carry it over the weekend. Now, up next, a conversation I held this morning outside of Cisco, Illinois, at an edge of field practice field day. We looked at two different technologies, a wood chip bioreactor and an end-of-field drainage management system. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're now joined by Rabin Bhattarai. He is in agricultural and bioengineering on campus and on site outside of Cisco and Cerro Gordo today with a biopit as well as some other structures to talk about drainage and nitrogen and nitrates and control of runoff that's coming off of the land, farmland in particular. Thank you, Rabin, for taking some time with me. Tell me about the structures we have looked at so far today and how much they really can do to help alleviate the loss, particularly of some of the nutrients that can come off of a field, whether it's corn or soybeans.
So the two practices that we saw today so far, one is called denitrifying bioreactor, or sometimes it's also called Urchi bioreactor. What it does basically is, rather than our tile water, which has elevated level of nitrate and phosphorus as well, rather than letting that water end up in our drainage ditch and ultimately Gulf of Mississippi River and Gulf and creating a big hypoxic zone there every summer, what we're trying to do is try to reduce that nitrate level in that water by digging a pit, fill that pit with the wood chips, and what it does is it enhances the process called denitrification, in which what we do, there's microorganisms that eat up the nitrate in the water and convert that nitrate into the nitrogen gas which already have in atmosphere. And that process is governed by how long the water stays in that pit, which we call retention time, and the temperature sometimes, because the process is governed by microbes which do not like cold temperatures. So that we have seen the system performance varies somewhere between 30 to 90% of nitrate removal by the load. So we can reduce anywhere from, like, let's say if you have 100 pounds of nitrate coming in into the tile water to your bioreactor, we can go between, let's say, 30 or 10 pounds out of the bioreactor. Okay. Depends. And we designed the system so that it can retain the water for somewhere between 12 to 24 hours, because that's the time we need that water to be cleaned up by the microbes. And the system works. We have done that. I have been actually monitoring this system across the state at the moment. I'm working with Farm Bureau, and we have been monitoring 8 of this system and across the state. And some are 10 years old, some are just installed last year, and we have seen the performance also changes over the time. Like initially, in the beginning, they are more efficient, but over the time, as your wood chips start to decompose, the system performance can go down over the years. Okay, and the other practice we just saw, that is called drainage water management. And the philosophy behind this practice is basically don't drain the fields when you don't need to. That means, especially in winter time, when you are not growing in corn or soybean in your field, what's the point of draining your field? So what this practice does is that we put a gate at the outlet of your drainage system, and we try to hold that water back into the field, especially over the winter time when you are not growing anything in the field, or also in the springtime. It helps you to drain the field faster so that you can do the planting, and then again, once you plant it, when you need the water, you can again shut down the gate and hold the water back into the field so that your plant can use it. And especially the system works on a dry years, like the year like this, like when you have wet spring and then we didn't have any rain for like almost whole July and like mid-August. That system can do is we can hold whatever rain we got in May and June, hold that water back, and then plant can use the water back in, let's say, month of July and August when there's no rain coming in. Especially this system helps the dry years, and we have seen that yield can go like 10, 15, even 20% up, especially when you manage the water properly in the system.
Both of these systems are designed, particularly in this case, and I think generally, to work with pattern tile.
Yes.
This last end of the system event, which is where you're holding the water back into the entirety of the field, leaves water that may also include nutrients there. One of the things that can help a crop that needs to reach down that deep, however the pattern tile deep is, to capture some extra nutrients along the way, particularly in dry years. The wood chip bioreactor is interesting because its function is relatively the same, but it is a treatment system rather than a system that's holding nutrients in place. Do you like to use them in combination, and are there places where one works better than the other?
Yes. So for this, we call this both practices, they call edge of the field practice. So that means you put the edge of the field before the water leaves the field somewhere else. And where bioreactor works versus where your drainage water management works, it's a kind of different your placement. Like, for example, if you have a flat field, okay, then those fields are pretty ideal for drainage water management, because drainage water management needs a field with a low gradient. Anything less than, let's say, 3%, 2% is very ideal, because here what we try to do is we hold the water and then we want to make sure that water reaches as back as far as possible. So if you have a pretty stiff field, with the effectiveness is not that much. The flat field, if you fill the 1 feet of water back, that can go cover, let's say, if you're 2% gradient, that will cover, let's say, if you're 100 feet long field, probably goes up to 50 feet, right? If that field is 5%, that only covers your 10 feet of the area. So drainage water management is more effective, especially if field is flat. And again, so sometimes we have done that, like we have to the cascade, like we have one system that covers one part of the field, we have another structure that covers the other part of the field, and we can stack them so that it covers the bigger area. When if you have, like, let's say 500 acres of field, one structure may not cover whole field, but then what you can do is we can stack the structures one over another one so that that covers different part of the field. Whereas your bioreactor is basically is your, once your water leaves the field, before that ends up in drainage ditch, we takes a little bit of land out of, most of the time, not even production, it's like basically is of your field, and then dig that trench, put that wood chips, sometime even cover that, fill that back with the dirt, and then you can still do the farming on top of that. And purpose is different, as you mentioned, like bioreactor is more like your denitrifying system, more like water cleanup before water leaves the field, where denitrifying water management is your conservation system, that you're putting the water and nutrient back to the field, that we can recycle that nutrient and water that is held by the your structure that can be used by the plant, and then that's why... Whereas you are with bioreactor, we may not see any yield benefit because it doesn't hold the water nutrient back into the field, but we try to recycle the water and then treat that. Whereas in drainage water management, we have seen that we are able to reduce anywhere between 20 to 40% less flow going out of the field, subsequently also 20 to 40% less nutrient leaving the field.
Rabin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd.
That's Rabin Bhattarai. He has been talking with us from Cisco, outside of Cisco, Illinois, at an Edge of Field Practice Conservation Field Day, sponsored by the Illinois Farm Bureau, the Land Improvement Contractors Association, and in association with the Lake Decatur Drainage District. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Let's turn our attention to the growing regions across the planet. Today, we'll stick mostly with the Corn Belt. Mike Tenora is here. He is a meteorologist and an agricultural economist as well, trained in both. And as with T-Storm Weather, where he serves as the president and CEO, you can find them online at tstorm.net. We have a lot to cover with you today, Mike. Thanks for being with us, by the way.
Well, Todd, thanks for having me here. And yes, this is turning into one of the more interesting growing seasons of recent years.
And today, I do want to lean a little bit on your statistical training today and the background that you have and some of the models you have developed over time. Let's begin, though, with what the weather has been like to this point and what some of your expectations might be.
Yeah, that sounds like a good plan. Let's just start with rainfall and think about what's happened this season. We got the corn and soybean crops planted in time, so that really wasn't much of a story this season. And then we had some really nice rains over most of the growing season until we got into the second half of July. And then all of a sudden, the rains kind of stopped for a couple of weeks, and it also turned pretty hot across a wide area. And so there was some concern not all that long ago about some dryness that was developing. Ever since we got out of late August, or late July, we've had some pretty great rains in a wide area over the first 5 to 10, even, all the way up to today in August. So rains have been pretty nice thus far. Some people might say, well, I had too much and I didn't get enough, but, you know, that does happen. So generally, though, rainfall has not really been all that much of a problem this season with all these different features kind of offsetting each other to this point.
So given the rainfall amount, and yesterday's USDA numbers, which were below the trend line that they had been using, does temperature have that much of an impact?
Well, it certainly can, depending on when the temperatures happen. In the scenario that we're in right now, it's kind of fascinating, but we talked about how rains were all looking pretty great right into the middle of July. And temperatures were also doing fine. There really wasn't anything much happening there. But then all of a sudden, once we got into late July, we had this burst of heat. And that's part of the reason I think that you're seeing a little bit of pain on the corn crop in particular, because it doesn't like heat in July. That's a well-known feature of corn development in the United States. And the other thing that's happened since then is that it's still been staying pretty hot in a lot of areas. Now, you might say to yourself, I don't know what this guy's talking about. It's been in the 80s, maybe 90. That's not really all that bad. But this is one of these scenarios which I get asked about a lot, but not too much this year, which is maybe a psychological thing, because this is the year to be asking this question, which is about warm nights. If you look at temperatures and how they've been bottoming out, they really haven't been falling out of the 70s much at all recently. And that's pretty warm for this time of the year, 5, 10, maybe even 12, 13 degrees above normal at night. And when you combine that with a daytime temperature that was pretty close to normal, or maybe a little bit above, you put those two together and that's pretty warm. And I think that's kind of what we're starting to see here. I'm assuming that the USDA numbers are onto something. It's basically just that rains have been okay, but temperatures have been too warm. And here's our concern, Todd, and this is what we've been trying to point out with our clients here for the last week or two. If you take some of the computer model projections, and we're just looking at the GFS model, which is kind of the main model that, you know, drives market expectations, and you take the ensemble run of that, which is about 50 different runs, and then you look at the European ensemble, which is about 30 different runs of that model, and you take what they're showing you and you project it out into the future, then we weight that by U.S. corn and soybean production at a really tiny, small scale level to get some really precise numbers and get a good understanding of what's going on. Well, this data is showing us that if these models are reasonably accurate, the next 14 days are going to end up being the warmest since 2003. And that was 23 years ago. And that is an extension of kind of what we had a flash of back in July and kind of what we're dealing with now. Even though temperatures don't look all that crazy, if you look at parts of the Corn Belt, the real problem is what's been happening in the far southern Corn Belt into the Mid-South and then extending into Kansas. Let's just focus on Kansas for a moment because I think this is being overlooked. Three of the last 4 days had a high temperature that was actually measured at 109 degrees in central Kansas. And that's a representative number for a pretty big part of that state, with most areas being anywhere from between 100 and 109 for the last 4 days in a row, with three of those, you know, right at 109. So, I mean, that's a problem. Even though it might not be a gigantic part of the U.S. corn and soybean crops, it is about 4 to 5% because it does extend into Colorado. And parts of that heat are basically what's going to be floating around in the southern U.S. for a while. And that's what's driving these numbers that I'm talking about so high with this really warm close. So yeah, it might not be the warmest close on record like that in Illinois alone or Iowa alone, but you aggregate it all up and you account for just how severe the heat is in those southern areas. And that's how we come up with this.
And the overnight lows, which aren't that low, above 70, really do cause a problem. And I guess I'm thinking about it in this way. If you don't get a good night's sleep, or if you just can't sleep and you're working, your productivity just goes down.
Well, that's a great analogy. I haven't heard that one, but I like that. And here's the other piece of it. I mean, if the high temperature, or let's say the low temperature was 75 degrees and you don't get a good night's sleep like you're talking about. But if the high temperature is 76 degrees, well, then you have a fantastic day. So you have this great, nice afternoon on this kind of poor night. But those average out and you end up right around 75 degrees for the whole day. And that generally is not too much of a problem. But in the case right now, we're having that kind of stressful night, 75 degrees. Then it's 90 during the day, which isn't a crazy number, but that's not helping you at all. That's just, you know, continuing the problem. Maybe not as severe as it would be like we're talking about in Kansas, but, you know, it's the combination of the two that you really need to look at. You can't just isolate them out.
Hey, thanks much. I appreciate it. We'll talk with you again next week.
Yeah, that sounds great.
That is Mike Tenere. He is with T-Storm Weather at tstorm.net online. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report on this Thursday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.